Blog Talk Radio.
This is the Sound Health Options Show with Richard Talk To Me Guy and Sherry Edwards. Good morning, Sherry.
Good morning. I saw your note that you're bragging that you're in the 70s out there today.
I wasn't. No, no, no. It wasn't bragging. It was confusion. I'm really ready for more rain, for actual winter. But, you know, it's going to be in the mid to possibly upper 70s today.
We are minus one today, and my furnace went out last night.
Oh.
So we're waiting. We're waiting. It's always an excitement, isn't it?
Oh,
always
man.
Always exciting going on. We have kind of a strange show today. We got in touch with Dr. Stephanie Seneff, who most of you are familiar with. She's been on the show many times. She is from MIT, and she is a researcher more than anything else, and she tells it like it is. And she's been bombarded and attacked many times for it, just like we have for a lot of things. So she's going to be on the show shortly in an interview with Dr. McCullough. He has asked us to share this with all of our friends and family. So she's going to be talking about a subject, glyphosate, which is what ends up being in the food when they make it impervious to Roundup. So we are going to share an interview with you because we asked her to be on the show, and she directed us here and said she's been speaking all over, and that's great and wonderful. So we have a couple of announcements. We're sponsored by the Institute of Bioacoustic Biology and Sound Health, and we're sponsored today by our Matters of the Heart since it's Valentine's Day. So we're going to make available our software so you can find your perfect mate. It's called Compatibility Compass to point you on your way. And you can go to our site, soundhealthoptions.com, go to more. We don't have its own little tag yet. And go to perfect mate and go down to the bottom and you can read all of the secrets about my vocal print. Sherry's compatibility. I was shocked at this because there were things in here I didn't even tell my husband of 40-some years, almost 50 years. I wrote the program, but I didn't expect it to tell on me. So that's one of the things. The other is you have asked us for the Zika frequencies, the antidote. So that's on our site under articles, under In the News and Articles. So, Richard, the order blank is right there on the site. Order here, it says, I think. Yeah, order form. So you can have that Valentine's Perfect Mate program. You need a registration number and you need a microphone. And then five little clicks of a button and it's yours. Do you have any announcements, Richard?
I have a tiny addition to the Seneff info, and then I do have a short announcement that ties right into this. I sent you that link in chat over at Skype. One of the things also that Seneff has really figured out, and they've started doing this recently with glyphosate or Roundup, is that they spray it on crops 2 or 3 days before harvest, because if the crop is not GMO, is non-Roundup ready, meaning there are some crops that are actually Roundup ready, which means that they can be sprayed with Roundup or glyphosate, and that will in turn kill all the weeds around it, but the crop that is Roundup ready will not die. So with wheat, which is not a Roundup ready crop, they spray the wheat 2 to 3 days before harvest because it helps get the wheat off of the stalks easier because it actually begins to kill the plant. And so that means that they're spraying the Roundup right on the plant 2 or 3 days before the harvest, the wheat berries that are then going to be ground into food for us, So they have a fresh spray of Roundup right before harvest.
Oh,
so
that's
that.
Cute.
Yeah, that's cute. So the announcement that Sherry has up is about this coffee farmer from Hawaii who is suing Monsanto for what the article title is, Coffee Farmer Sues Monsanto for Hiding Cancer-Causing Impact of Glyphosate. And so she's was a coffee farmer in Hawaii for a number of years. And there are dates in there. I forget when she started, but she stopped, I think, in 08 and had to move back to the United States to have cancer therapy because she developed lymphoma. And so this coffee farmer is suing Monsanto for hiding the lies about cancer-causing issues with glyphosate. So I thought that fit right into the show today. I just found this today.
I think we're getting poisoned all around with a lot of different things, and you'll see that in the video today. We are simultaneously broadcasting. We have chats at both Blog Talk Radio and over on our WebEx if people want to chat about how this affects their life. We do have a computer program that looks at this. It's called YeGAD, and the GAD stands for glutathione anhydro. I can't remember the whole name of it. Glutathione anhydrinase, I think. And it's what gets messed up in the body when you eat these foods. So, Richard, no more announcements?
I'm over here chuckling because that software, the title of that software is so perfect. It is really so much a YeGAD. It is just stunning. I mean, it's just stunning. That's all I can say on air. I have no
so
more. I have nothing else to say for myself.
So we can run you through that if you'll send us your vocal print. And there's information on Sound Health Options under Clinical Services. So if you want to send us your information and see if you're having any trouble with this. So there's a couple things in chat already. Some wheat has been genetically modified. I think it was in Australia where the tests were occurring. A modified wheat gene was the one that matches a human gene. Oh, good grief. Well, watch the chats as we go on through the video because there's a lot of good people listening and they have a lot of good information. And our people are sharers. They want everybody to have optimal health. Okay, we ready to go, Richard?
We're ready. Here we go.
The gut, of course, is a mess because of the glyphosate. That's the thing. Many, many people have really damaged gut, you know, inflamed gut, overgrowth of pathogens. Glyphosate does that to you. You've got all this stuff around you poisoning you, and you don't know which foods are safe. We need to save ourselves, and we can do so. We can empower ourselves, and we can feel good about ourselves that we're contributing to the solution rather than to the problem.
Is it possible that GMO foods are increasing the risk of celiac disease? Hi, this is Dr. Mercola helping you take control of your health. And today we are joined by Dr. Stephanie Seneff, who is a research professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and has developed a recent passion for integrating much of health information research into some interesting theories. And she's come up with some phenomenal research on this connection. So welcome, and thank you for joining us from Maui, Hawaii today, Dr. Seneff. I'm sorry, Kauai.
Thank you. That's right, Kauai. My pleasure to be here. Delighted always to speak with you.
Okay, so maybe you can give us some background on what started the process. Why would you even begin to investigate the relationship between GMOs and celiac disease?
You know, I've been looking at the relationship between glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup, and a host of modern diseases. There's extremely strong correlation between the use of Roundup on corn and soy over time and the increase in all these different diseases, and celiac disease is one of them. I mean, we certainly have seen an explosive appearance of celiac disease almost overnight in the last, you know, 5-10 years. You know, I had never heard of celiac disease, I think, 10 years ago. I wouldn't have known what it was. And now you have all the grocery stores with huge section, growing section of gluten-free choices.
And most of those choices are not healthy.
No, I know, but they're getting rid of the gluten because they know the gluten is going to cause a reaction to so many people in the population. And it's like we don't seem to, it's funny to me how these things happen all around you, and people somehow think, oh yeah, wheat, you know, lots of people are intolerant to wheat. Of course they are. I mean, people aren't thinking, why is this true? Why is this now true? This didn't used to be true. People don't seem to question the new reality the way they should be, you know, I feel. So anyway, I was curious. It was like, what's going on here? And I was really puzzled because wheat is not a GMO product. I mean, Monsanto has produced a GMO wheat, Roundup Ready wheat, and the farmers refused to use it. You know, it has not been embraced. In fact, there was that wheat that got loose. You know, we had that story on the West Coast that somehow had gotten loose from the experimental site and was getting into the wheat crop.
Yeah, so that's good to clear up the confusion. There is no GMO wheat.
GMO wheat is not a product that's on the market.
Right.
So that's why, if you think of GMOs, well, why would, you know, it be connected at all? Mm-hmm. And it's actually not because it's GMO. It's because it's not GMO that what they do actually works at all. Because they, and I was stunned to find this out. It was when I started investigating. I was curious about it. You know, celiac disease. I'm looking at all the diseases that are on the rise, and then I'm trying to see how they could connect with glyphosate. Because glyphosate is the only herbicide that's going up dramatically in the last 15 years. It's exactly in step with the use on GMO.
Let's stop there. Let's talk about the increase in the incidence of celiac disease and the increase in the use of glyphosate.
Yeah, I mean, they go up hand in hand, and particularly this is glyphosate usage on wheat. So luckily, the U.S. government doesn't keep a whole lot of statistics on pesticides, but they do have information you can get on the web on glyphosate usage on corn and soy and glyphosate usage on wheat. And so so the obvious thing to do with gluten intolerance is to look at glyphosate usage on wheat and see if that correlates with gluten intolerance. And in fact, it correlates a lot better than does glyphosate usage on corn and soy, which makes sense because wheat's the product that you get sensitive to. But this does point to the connection between the wheat and the glyphosate as being somehow inducing the celiac disease.
And why would they use glyphosate on a non-GMO wheat?
It's an excellent, excellent question. I was wondering that myself. I was like, why is this going up? And in fact, it turns out they have they've been advocating, and they started doing research, I think maybe 15 years ago, on this concept of desiccation of the crop with some poison right before the harvest. They're sort of thinking, well, we have all this stuff we have to clear away to get ready for next year's crop. And of course, we have weeds already infiltrating the crop. What if we could combine two steps in one by spraying the wheat with Roundup in order to kill it right before we harvest the seed? So the wheat's ready to go, and actually when you expose the wheat to a toxic chemical like glyphosate, it releases more seeds. It sort of goes to seed as it dies. So in its last gasp, it releases seeds. You get a higher yield because you can then synchronize when the seed arrives. You grab it, you know, with a combine. You wipe out the crop, you want to clear it, and of course because it's dying so quickly, there's less to clear. So you sort of want it to die now that you've harvested the wheat. But you do this killing before the harvest, which is like so bizarre to me, that you're pouring the glyphosate right into the seed as you do that. And no one thinks that's a problem. I mean, I'm just like so baffled by that.
Well, it's interesting too. It's not that anyone believes that's an issue, but that information isn't widely known. I didn't know about it until you just shared it, that they were using it to increase. I imagine most people watching this weren't aware of that.
No, it's not something I knew either. You know, once you look, you find, but
Is this being done on almost all wheat crops? Is this being
I don't know how many, because it's hard to find, actually. It's hard to know exactly who. But when you see the evidence that the use of glyphosate on wheat is going up dramatically in the last, 5-10 years, You can, and then you see the articles that say this is a great thing to do. You know, I've seen Monsanto documents that were released in Europe saying, "Oh, you guys should do this. This is great." You know, and here's why. That's how I learned. These are all the reasons why it's good. It kills the ryegrass, which they've got a problem with ryegrass that's resistant to these other herbicides. So they get rid of the ryegrass for next year's crop, you know, before it has a chance to kind of go to seed and cause a mess as well, because you'll get that all as a weed, interfering with the wheat. You don't want the ryegrass in there, but it's a serious weed problem for the wheat. So they think it's really handy. You know, the only problem is, of course, you're poisoning your population. But they don't think that's a problem because they don't think glyphosate's poisonous.
And it poisons the planet, too, because killing the ryegrass is growing there for a reason, to rebalance the soil. It's viewed as a weed, but actually it's a highly beneficial plant to nourish the soil back to health.
Yes, I know. It's actually true with many of the weeds. It's quite interesting that you can let the weeds grow and improve the quality of the soil.
Yeah. So gosh, that is just amazing information with this.
It's so shocking.
So there's more there's glyphosate now in a large portion of the wheat supply that a large percentage of processed foods are made from. So it's getting into the food supply. How did you make the connection between that and the celiac disease? And just for definition, celiac disease is a reaction to gluten, but it's concentrated on the gastrointestinal system that can result in loose stools and
right. And of course, what happens is that the villi that are in the gut get destroyed, and then you get a whole bunch of problems with you can't absorb minerals and vitamins. You have you get into B vitamin deficiency like cobalamin, and you get into mineral deficiencies because you can't absorb things properly because the villi are basically stripped clear. They're not healthy in the higher upper gut, and you get a reaction to the. It's really fascinating. We did a really interesting kind of chemical study of the glyphosate and how it might mess up the processing of the gliadin. In the wheat, there's this gliadin, which is difficult to break down. And there's a reaction that takes place that builds connections across between different proteins in the wheat. But the glyphosate gets right in the middle of that and makes a mess out of it, we think. Because glyphosate, we explained in our paper. By the way, Anthony Sansel and I wrote a paper on celiac disease. It was our second paper on glyphosate, which appeared last December. And it's a long paper with a lot of details. So if you want to learn more, you can read that paper.
Yeah, we'll have a link.
300 references.
And Anthony Sampson is actually a subscriber to the newsletter and posts on our forum quite a bit. So.
Yes, he's fantastic.
Actually, I introduced both of you together. He was objecting to your comments on cholesterol and sunshine, and then I said, well, listen, you've got to discuss this issue with him so he doesn't beat us up on the forums.
Oh, is that right?
But as a result of that, you started writing papers together, which is really terrific.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. No, he's great. I really enjoy working with him. He's really brilliant, and he's a walking encyclopedia. So he gives me all this knowledge, and then I can try to use my thinking, creative thinking, to try to hook it all together. It's a giant puzzle, and it's really fun to do the research, but it's incredibly disturbing what I'm finding, just incredibly disturbing. And the glyphosate gets in the way so that the wheat doesn't do the right thing so that you can digest it. So the wheat becomes, and then it also, I think the glyphosate is probably attached to the gliadin as a consequence of its chemical reaction with it. And it's that your body develops, an immunity to the enzyme that's trying to do this thing, because the enzyme is all in the mix there. And there's this crazy molecule the body sees and says, oh, this must be foreign, and it develops antibodies to it. And then you get this transglutaminate antibody reaction, which is the characteristic feature of celiac disease. I think it comes about because the glyphosate's in the mix there and messes everything up.
Gosh. And when did you start noticing this increased incidence of celiac disease?
It was a few years back. It was before I really had linked to glyphosate. I was just kind of puzzled. I mean, I'm watching to see. I started with autism. I was very worried about autism 7 years ago. And that was when I really started looking into biology in a serious way. And I believe I really understand autism now, and it's really scary because it's a combination of the glyphosate. The glyphosate plays a really critical role in autism, and along with it is the aluminum in the vaccines. The two of them are synergistically toxic, and I think that goes a long ways towards explaining the autism epidemic. And I've talked about that, before, but...
Well, maybe you could summarize a few of the highlights now, how the interaction contributes to the autism.
Yeah, it's remarkable. Of course, we're getting a lot of aluminum in the vaccines, and the government assures us it's not a problem, but it is. Aluminum directly injected gets 100% into the body.
And many people believe that's more dangerous than the mercury or the thimerosal that's in the vaccine.
I believe it is. Well, especially because there's much more of it. They love the aluminum because it makes you it makes the immune reaction much stronger, and that means
so
they can
imagine.
Use less of the antigen.
Yeah.
Just like the glyphosate, really, it has a very useful role. And then they want us to believe, they want to believe themselves that it's not toxic, but it is. It's very clear that the aluminum is toxic, especially working with the glyphosate. Because the glyphosate basically, we've written about it in other papers that I've talked about. I have other papers published that talk about this, but the glyphosate binds to the aluminum and then carries it to the brain and drops it off, basically. In the brainstem. And so both the glyphosate and the aluminum arrive at the brainstem and do a nasty job for for example, in the pineal gland. And the pineal gland, of course, produces melatonin, which allows you to sleep. And sleep disorder is associated with all these neurological diseases, you know, autism, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, all of them, and depression are associated with sleep disorder. And I think that's because the pineal gland is being messed up. It is especially, the pineal gland especially absorbs aluminum compared to other parts of the brain.
So you believe the primary role of glyphosate is a transporter for the aluminum into the brain?
Yeah, well, of course, it transports the glyphosate as well. So the two of them packaged together are safe. It's like an inert molecule. But when they get into an acidic environment, which is the terminal watershed of the circulation, which is the pineal gland, that's at the end of the line, it becomes acidic because the blood becomes more and more acidic as you get further and further to the end. So the pineal gland has an acidic environment. And in an acid environment, the aluminum and the glyphosate break apart. And both of them become very toxic at that point. So it's like a stealth bomb delivered to the pineal gland. Same thing goes on with arsenic in the kidneys. That was written about by some Sri Lankans who were studying why the agricultural workers were all dying of kidney failure in Sri Lanka. And they attributed it to glyphosate plus arsenic, which is very similar. Arsenic is very similar to aluminum. Both of them are toxic metals that have a +3 charge.
And once it gets into the pineal gland, what type of actions are occurring? Are they actually killing the cells, and can this be documented
totally
by imaging studies?
Well, I have a whole theory about, you know, sulfate synthesis by Enos that I've talked about before, mm-hmm. and I've published several papers on that now. Very, very important. I think I'm right with this, and it's very, very significant in terms of the impact of what that means. And there's Enos and Endos, two different nitric oxide synthases in the pineal gland. The pineal gland sits right behind the eyes, so it gets lots of sunlight through the eyes, and it uses the sunlight to make sulfate. This is what I believe. It certainly makes sulfate, and it needs sulfate. It piles up sulfated molecules, sugar molecules, actually, outside the cell by day. And then at nighttime, it takes the melatonin, attaches it to the sulfate, and ships it into the cerebrospinal fluid, delivering the melatonin and the sulfate to all the neurons. Really, really important what happens when you sleep. And the sulfate is really, really important for the brain to be able to recycle garbage. So we've talked about that in, well, there's this presentation I gave in Nice, and you've actually got on your site, there's an article by Claire Viagro, I think.
Right. She did a summary of your presentation there.
Yeah, she did a nice job summarizing that presentation that I did in Nice at an aluminum conference, or at a special workshop on aluminum in a conference on autoimmune diseases. It's fascinating stuff, but I feel like that's a huge part of the puzzle in autism and in Alzheimer's disease, by the way. I think they're sort of very similar pathologies in two different age groups, and both are caused by, I think, this glyphosate plus aluminum delivery to the brainstem.
I didn't realize that the pineal gland was so close to the optic nerve and got direct input from the sunlight, and even though I've taken anatomy, neuroanatomy courses, it just never clicked in for that was actually going on. But just your awareness of its physical proximity allowed you to think about the sunlight and sulfur connection? I mean, how did you come to that?
Yeah, and even, of course, there's other evidence that it responds to the sunlight. There has DHEA, I'm forgetting the name, but there's an important DHA.
DHEA sulfate?
No, yeah, well, there is that, too, which is involved, but there's also this fatty acid.
DHA?
Fatty acid, DHA, right? Do you know? You must know. EPA, DHA, there's
a dihydro...
important fatty acid.
DHA. It's EPA, DHA. DHA is the one that... I think it's the majority of the fatty acids that are in the brain are DHA, and that's what you really need.
Yeah, and it's really important because it actually fits very well with the cholesterol sulfate. So the two of them work together to create, we believe, and we're doing research on this, and it's hard, so we haven't written it up yet because we don't have the whole story yet, but I think the DHA and the cholesterol sulfate work together to create electron movement, and basically electricity, that allows this sulfate to be produced. And more, you know, you have the cholesterol sulfate, and the sulfate begets sulfate because the sulfate creates the appropriate water environment. It's a really fascinating water plays a really important role, and water has really interesting properties, and we're studying all of this. It's really hard stuff. But the pineal gland definitely makes the sulfate by day in response to sunlight. There's papers on that. We have a paper that we referred to in our paper and then it makes these sulfated glycosaminoglycans that it parks outside the cell. It's like storing the sulfate by day and making it and storing it. And then when you don't have the sunlight anymore, that's when you release the sulfate attached to the melatonin, and that's how you deliver the sulfate to the brain.
Really? So one of melatonin's roles is to deliver sulfate?
I'm absolutely certain. I mean, there's
but
a very
that's
high,
not widely appreciated or even understood, is it? Because I've never heard that
No
before.
One talks about it. No one talks about it. No, it's really important. When you start looking at all these molecules that can be sulfated and are sulfated in transit, no one thinks, oh, maybe they're transporting the sulfate, which is exactly what they're doing. It's very clear to me. The melatonin is delivering the sulfate to the brain, which the brain desperately needs in order to, as I said, to break down. Sulfate makes sulfuric acid in the lysosome where you break down cellular debris. So you have like broken mitochondria. The mitochondria work hard and get damaged, and they need to be recycled. And that's done through the lysosome. And it needs the sulfate to create this acidic environment that will allow it to break down the molecules and then repurpose them into new molecules. So if you can't do that, you end up with all these broken mitochondria lying around. They cause all kinds of problems because they release all these reactive oxygen species and eventually they kill the neurons.
Yeah, they create free radicals.
Exactly. Yeah.
And the free radical causes the damage. And some of it supposedly could be irreparable.
But you've got to hang on to them if you can't recycle them. You know, so you just get these old and dying, damaged mitochondria causing tons of trouble because you don't have enough sulfate to break them down.
Do you think that's one of the reasons why melatonin taken orally or externally, some people use it sublingually or intranasally, would not work as well as the one that's produced by the brain?
Well, you need the sulfate. You know, if you don't have the sulfate,
so
it's going to be a problem transporting the melatonin. And you can't deliver the sulfate if you don't have it.
So if you're sulfate deficient, taking melatonin might not be that useful. But if you have adequate sulfate levels, it might work.
Right, exactly. Yeah, you need the sulfate.
Interesting. That is
interesting. There's various sulfated molecules that are, like even magnesium sulfate, you know, and glucosamine sulfate, all those sulfated nutrients that you take. I think it's the sulfate that's actually the healthy part of that molecule.
Phenomenally important for joint health.
Yeah,
arthritis.
Glucosamine sulfate, and you probably know all these sulfated things. I'm forgetting the other one, but magnesium sulfate, glucosamine sulfate, and chondroitin sulfate.
Chondroitin sulfate. Yes. Now, one of the last times we talked, you had your views on sulfate supplementation. At that time, I believe your recommendation or advice was to soak in magnesium sulfate baths or Epsom salt.
I like that because it gets past the gut barrier. The gut, of course, is a mess because of the glyphosate. That's the thing. Many, many people have really damaged gut, you know, inflamed gut, overgrowth of pathogens. Glyphosate does that to you.
So if that's the case and you take an oral sulfur supplement, it's not going to penetrate the gut mucosa.
Yeah, it's difficult to transport sulfate. That's why you have all these special molecules that do it. There's two classes of molecules that transport sulfate. One is the sterols. So that's going to be cholesterol, vitamin D, all the sex hormones, you know, estrogen and testosterone and DHEA, all those guys are sterols that transport sulfate. And then you have on the other side, you have all the neurotransmitters. And this is the dopamine and the melatonin and the serotonin adrenaline, all of those transport sulfate. And they're all derived from this pathway that glyphosate disrupts. So glyphosate disrupts the shikimate pathway, which is a biological pathway in plants and in microbes. And that pathway produces the precursors to all those neurotransmitters. So when you can't produce those precursors, which we depend on these microbes to do for us because we can't make those molecules, so the microbes can't make the molecules because of the glyphosate, and therefore we become deficient. This links directly to the celiac disease because the serotonin, serotonin is very strongly implicated in celiac disease, and in fact you have an overproduction of serotonin whenever you have dietary tryptophan in celiac. These cells are hypersensitized, and they take in the tryptophan and make serotonin out of it. Tryptophan is one of the products of this pathway that glyphosate disrupts. So the body is really eager to grab every bit of tryptophan it can find in the diet and immediately turn it into serotonin because you're desperate for serotonin. But too much serotonin causes diarrhea. So that's how you get a connection to the celiac disease behavior.
And most of the serotonin is produced in the gut, though, by the gut microbes.
It's fascinating. It's actually produced in the gut. Most of the serotonin that's produced in the body is produced in the gut by these cells that are on overdrive in celiac disease.
Oh, is it our cells or is it the microbes?
Our cells produce the serotonin, but they do it from the tryptophan. And the tryptophan can be made by the gut bacteria, but if they're exposed to glyphosate, they can't do it.
Okay, that's the connection. So they convert tryptophan to serotonin.
And actually, wheat's a good source of tryptophan. So you're getting the tryptophan from the wheat, which is causing these cells to go into overdrive. Mm-hmm. And then you get too much serotonin. But it's making it because it's desperate to ship sulfate, because serotonin becomes sulfated and gets shipped to the brain as serotonin sulfate. So your body's desperate to get sulfate to the brain, and you're willing to put up with the diarrhea and the indigestion and even nausea in order to do that, because you're so desperate for the sulfate.
I'm just curious if you have any thoughts on it. It would seem there's obviously drugs, antidepressants, serotonin, selective serotonin uptake inhibitors,
right.
SSRIs, and they work by increasing serotonin levels. But it would seem like they would work far better if you had an adequate sulfur intake.
They, you know, all these drugs basically work by fooling the body into thinking everything's okay when it's not. You know, by making the serotonin linger longer, you fool the body into thinking there's more of it, but there isn't, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you can't recycle it. So that's what it does. It gets it trapped, you know?
Yeah, those drugs, those antidepressant drugs, they just leave it in the synapse longer. They do not increase the production of serotonin. They actually relatively slowly decrease the degradation. So it's there for a shorter amount of time. So I'm sorry to interrupt, but I don't think a lot of people would know that. So I just wanted to throw that in.
I'm really glad you said that, because that's important. And in fact, that means there's not more of it. You know, your body thinks there's more of it. You know, it's fooled, basically. And that makes your body react in a certain way, which might make you momentarily feel better. But in the long run, you're going to be worse off. So once you take the drug for, say, 9 months or something, now your brain is really in trouble with the sulfate deficiency. So as soon as you go off the drug, all those signals are going to be screaming at you, hey, you need sulfate, you know. So you're basically going to be in big trouble in the brain. It's going to make your brain worse in the long run.
So what's your guess that taking sulfate alone without the antidepressant drugs would be more beneficial, or taking it with the drugs has some sort of synergistic effect?
The problem is that sulfate transport can be very dangerous if you don't have these molecules to transport it, because sulfate gels the blood. That's the reason why, one of the reasons why it's good is because it gels the blood.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't want it to be gelling the blood in the lumen, in the main artery. You know, if you turn blood into jello, you're going to be in trouble, big trouble, if you do that in a major artery. So transporting sulfate is really tricky. That's why it has all these molecules to transport it. So if you don't have enough of those transporters, then you get in trouble with too much sulfate. And what will happen is your gut bacteria will help you out. I mean, gut bacteria are always looking to help you out, because if you don't survive, they don't survive.
Mm-hmm.
They want you to live. So when they see all this excess sulfate, and they, in a sense, they realize, oh, my God, we've got a problem here, they reduce the sulfate to hydrogen sulfide gas. And then you can get into big trouble if they overdo it, because if you get too much hydrogen sulfide gas, it can kill you. You know, but people get into trouble with ingesting sulfate because they've got these bacteria in the gut that are reducing it to hydrogen sulfide gas. And they're doing that because you can't transport it. You know, you can't get the sulfate from the gut to the liver because you don't have those carrier molecules.
So what's the trick to increase the carrier molecules?
I'll tell you a great trick, which is to eat all these polyphenols. There's all these foods that are good sources of polyphenols, which are, in fact, can carry sulfate.
Mm-hmm.
They're related to the serotonin. You know, they have this. There's this characteristic feature of this ring, this sort of carbon ring, a six-carbon ring, with oxidized with some hydroxyls. You can stick some sulfates on those, and then they distribute the negative charge so the sulfate can safely be shipped. And so all these coffee, tea, chocolate, wine, you know, red wine, resveratrol, curcumin, the spices, all those.
And number of fruits. Number of fruits,
yeah.
Too.
Right, all the fruits, any multiple, you know, colored, bright
berries.
Colored, brightly colored fruits and vegetables, all of those things contain these polyphenols that transport sulfate. And I think that's what makes them healthy. And, you know, you don't hear anybody else saying that, but it's quite fascinating. I mean, I've read many articles that have puzzled over how is it that curcumin is, or resveratrol, how does it work? Because they see that it goes around and around in the gut, from the gut to the liver. It goes around and around. You know, it goes from the gut to the liver carrying sulfate, drops off the sulfate in the liver, and then it gets glucuronylated and sent back around to the gut. And then it gets sulfated and gets sent back to the liver. So it goes around and around. It never makes it into the general circulation. They see very small amounts. make it in. So they say it's very poorly absorbed. But the fact is it's doing its job, because its job is to deliver sulfate to the liver.
That's interesting. You know,
yeah, and so it doesn't need to get into the general circulation to be useful for you. They don't realize that.
Is it one of the only herbs I know of that is almost universally effective for just about every type of cancer? And I've never understood why, but that's just an observation, because I know a lot of natural physicians who use it, and that's their observation. So it's indirect from me. But maybe it's because it's serving as a form of the sulfur transportation.
I would bet money that's the case.
Then the body utilizes it to upregulate its mechanisms to defeat the cancer.
Yeah. Well, cancer, I think, is a direct consequence of sulfate.
Why don't you expand on that? Because
it's really interesting, because you see the sulfate, so the cells make this extracellular matrix, really fascinating. They make this complex sugar chain molecule, and they stick a bunch of sulfates on it. So it's got lots of big names. Sulfated glycosaminoglycans is a name for this extracellular matrix protein. There's a protein, and there's sugars stuck on it, and there's sulfates stuck on the sugars. Very complicated. Really fascinating, because the cells make this matrix, and the matrix then, the sulfates create structured water. They gel the blood. I mentioned that before, which is really important when it's stuck to the membrane of a cell. It gels the water around it and makes that water into jello, which actually prevents anything from getting in. It's sort of building a barrier around the cell to keep it safe from, you know. And also inside that barrier, it can mobilize electrons. So it creates electrical supply for the cell. So the sulfate, it has two very important roles. One is to keep stuff out that the cell doesn't want to be exposed to, like toxic chemicals. Mm-hmm. And two is to provide electricity to the cell. Two really, really important roles for the sulfate in those extracellular matrix proteins. So really fascinating. So if the cell can't make enough sulfate to support that, then it gets in trouble. And it kind of tumbles away from the matrix. It's sort of losing its connectivity to the network in the world. And it becomes autonomous. It sort of rounds up and turns into kind of an embryonic state. And then it basically starts multiplying itself. So the endothelial cells do this. When they don't have enough sulfate, they start reproducing themselves. They turn into a they no longer play their normal role. And instead, they just start multiplying. And as they multiply, they release chondroitin sulfate. It's really fascinating. They only release that when they are reproducing. And the chondroitin sulfate is spilled out into the environment and then immediately attacked by these enzymes that send it off down the bloodstream to supply sulfate. So basically, the cell is saying, oh, my God, there's not enough sulfate here. We need more. And then the cell starts turning into this different kind of activity, which involves reproducing itself and releasing a sulfated molecule. Really fascinating. And then, as I said, it gets attacked, and then the sulfate gets delivered, and so the rest of the bloodstream down the road is benefiting from this sulfate that's being produced by this reproducing endothelial cell. Well, that gets really close to cancer. I mean, cancer is basically rounded up into a cell that all it does is multiply. You know,
sure.
It just makes more of itself. And it also produces sulfate. It produces, for example, breast cancer produces estrone sulfate, lots of it. And prostate cancer produces cholesterol sulfate, my favorite molecule. It's a marker for prostate cancer. So the cancer is actually knows it's in trouble because there's not enough sulfate, switches into a different mode, which no longer doing whatever you're supposed to do in your differentiated state, and instead becoming an embryonic cell, multiplying, making more of yourself, and then all the clones that you're making are also making estrone sulfate. So you're supplying sulfate to the world as a tumor. Very, very novel perspective on tumors. They're trying to solve their local problem, and then their sulfated molecules get stolen by the macrophages that come in. They steal it, and that's delivering sulfate to the blood, which is essential because otherwise you'll die if the blood doesn't have enough sulfate.
Fascinating theory. So have you explored therapeutic options to address this deficiency? I mean, obviously curcumin appears to be clinically useful, but just combining curcumin in enough healthy gut flora and the sulfur, that combination, and staying away from glyphosate, because obviously that interferes with the process.
Yeah.
So that would be pretty much all wheat. Seems to be like the prescription. Would you have any comments on that?
Yeah, 100% organic diet. Eat tons of these polyphenol-containing substances. You know, like I said, the tea, the curcumin, eat lots of spice. the curries, you know, chicken curries and things like that. Coconut, by the way, coconut is extremely helpful. Coconut oil is a medium-chain fatty acid, mm-hmm. and the medium-chain fatty acids actually transport sulfate to the liver. So
really?
That's another way to transport sulfate.
That is fascinating. I never knew that.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
So any recommendations as to how to do that? Would it be not a large dose once a day, or would it be smaller doses throughout the day?
I would eat the foods. I mean, I don't like, as you know,
no,
I don't. I would prefer to get
the
it from
coconut.
Food if you could, because you've got a very complex combination of all these different things that work together to do whatever it is that needs to be done. Whereas you take any individual supplement, you're getting a large concentration of one thing, which may not be in an environment where it can make use of itself because maybe the sulfate's not there. I mean, it's, you know, it's sort of like it all comes together. Like, for example, wine is really good. Wine's a great red wine, you know. It's got the resveratrol, but it's got all the other stuff there as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's got the sulfur, you know.
Fermented.
Yes, exactly. Fermented is really important. I didn't mention that, but fermented foods, spices, you know, and things like basil and parsley, all these flavorful spices that we use in cooking, use tons of them. You know, garlic, ginger, I mentioned the curcumin, which is incredible. Many articles on curcumin showing so many benefits. They think that's why the people in India.
And curcumin is an extract of turmeric.
Yes, right.
Turmeric, and of course curry powders have that
in them. And
right.
So the Indian people eat lots and lots of curry, and that's even protecting them from Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's, of course, is also a sulfate deficiency problem. So all these things will help protect you from both cancer and these debilitating diseases like Alzheimer's.
Is the mechanism with Alzheimer's any different than what you previously discussed, or is it the same?
I think it's the same as autism, pretty much the same. And actually, you see a lot of parallels. You know, both autism and Alzheimer's are characterized by these mitochondria that are broken. You know, they're not working well. They're aged and crippled, and they're producing too many. They get to where they produce these reactive oxygen that you can't control, you know, when they get old. But you can't recycle them because you don't have enough sulfate to clear them out. So they have to keep on limping along and causing damage because of the lack of sulfate.
This fascinating information is just really illuminating. But let's get back to celiac. And are there any other important highlights you'd like to expand on?
Many. There's many. I mean, celiac disease is quite fascinating. And once Anthony and I started studying it, and we found all these comorbidities, various diseases or conditions that are more common in people who have celiac disease compared to the normal population. And, for example, they have a higher risk of producing children with disabilities, various birth defects. And a very interesting one is something called anencephaly or microcephaly, which is basically a missing brain or small brain. You can imagine that's a very serious birth defect. It's interesting that there's been an epidemic of an extremely rare disorder, anencephaly, born in babies in Washington State, Yakima, Washington. They've had it's so rare that you usually have only one in the entire U.S. population every year mm-hmm. who has this condition, and they had a string of maybe 20 kids with this problem over the course of 2 or 3 years. So they noticed there was a problem, and they started looking at all the different. They had, of course, all these different chemicals that were being used in agriculture, and they looked at everything except glyphosate. They didn't look at glyphosate because they considered it to be harmless. They were using tons of it around the waterways.
And that's not an abstract term. It's literally tons.
Yeah, probably so. I mean, it was clear they were using lots of glyphosate. There have been papers written that have shown that glyphosate causes anencephaly in frogs. And so clear connection there. And I even know why, because it's because of excess retinoic acid, which is well known to cause anencephaly, too much retinoic acid. And glyphosate disrupts cytochrome P450 enzymes in the liver. And it's a CYP enzyme. Those are called CYP enzymes. And it's a CYP enzyme that breaks down retinoic acid. So when you can't break it down, just like you hold the serotonin in the synapse with these drugs, the retinoic acid builds up and becomes toxic to the embryo. Very clear to me, that connection. And then, of course, the celiac disease is an indicator of glyphosate exposure. Celiac patients also have a very high risk to cancer. That's probably why they die prematurely. They typically live a short life. And I think their life
which type of cancer?
Maybe 4 or 5 years.
GI cancers or?
Yeah, GI cancers, and they have this non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, they have a very high risk to that compared to the normal population. And glyphosate has been implicated in multiple papers as a link to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Many other of the pesticides have as well. I mean, it really is connected to the pesticides. Many pesticides cause this increased risk to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
So if someone had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and exposure to glyphosate might be a risk factor, are there any recommendations you would have?
Well, certainly go organic. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously that's the case. Get away from the glyphosate. But to address the metabolic dysfunctions, which contributed to the molecular pathology of the lymphoma.
I mean, I believe everything has to do with this sulfate deficiency. So it's the same prescription for all the diseases, in my opinion. I think, you know, if you start supplying yourself with sulfur, by the way, garlic is an incredibly good source of sulfur. I eat tons of it.
Any special ways to prepare it? Because some people, you know, there's a lot of confusion.
Less cooked is more potent.
Okay.
So if you cook it, of course, it's also more tasty. I mean, if you don't like the garlic flavor, then that's a problem. But raw garlic would be the best. So light cooking, I guess, would be the thing if you need to cook it.
Would you say that's perhaps one of the best food sources of sulfur?
I think it is, because it has sulfur, and again, it matters how the sulfur comes, and it has sulfur in this very nice format where it's easier to transport, because you can sort of transport the sulfur when it's not yet sulfate. You can transport it more easily, so you don't have to worry about this whole issue of sulfate transport, because the garlic form of sulfur is easier to transport, and then the red blood cells actually oxidize it to sulfate. So it just gets into the blood as this thing called sulforaphane.
It would seem a combination of food-based garlic and curcumin would be a powerful tool to get the sulfur working the way it was designed to is a pretty potent way to address the cancers.
Yes, and of course there's other deficiencies too. Lately I've been studying manganese. Manganese is very interesting, and Anthony and I are working on a paper on manganese right now. That hopefully will eventually get published. We haven't submitted it yet. We're finding out really fascinating things about manganese, and we think glyphosate is totally disrupting the homeostasis of manganese, such that it ends up being both toxic and deficient simultaneously in different parts of the body.
Yeah, because it is really a trace mineral. If you get too much manganese, it can cause complications too.
It can cause Parkinson's.
I mean, that's one of the symptoms of problems with soy, especially in children. It's just loaded with manganese in infant formulas, and they get levels far in excess of what they're needed, and it causes loads of toxicity.
And I wonder if they started doing that because they were noticing manganese deficiency, because it's very, very interesting that in the pig studies, they've been seeing the manganese deficiency in the deformed pigs. The farming people have been studying the farm animals a lot lately, and they've been discovering, you know, the disrupted gut. They see the inflamed gut in the pig. They're seeing pigs being born with deformities, very big problem with, and also with infertility. So the pigs are really suffering because they're eating tons of GMO Roundup Ready corn and soy.
Well, we have 10% of the pig population dying from this virus that causes this diarrhea.
I forget the specific name of the virus, but it's
killed off 10% of the pork.
Population. Yeah, wow. They're going to have to wake up and realize that they've got to get away from these GMO corn and soy diet for their animals. I mean, of course, it's going into their system as well. It's being retained in their tissues. It's been found in the muscle tissue.
Well, that would make sense now, too, especially with the observation you've had with the celiac disease, that they have this diarrhea-type illness, obviously, which is a gut issue, and it's largely related
to
the fact that they've increased the concentration of glyphosate they're feeding to these animals.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
The price of pork has gone up pretty high because of this kill. You know, when you kill off 10% of the animals, that's definitely a problem.
Yeah, and they're having trouble with infertility, and as I said, these deformed pigs are finding glyphosate in the urine of the deformed pigs, and they're finding manganese deficiency. Because of the disrupted manganese transport, it's not getting to the embryo during development. So I think the children are also suffering from manganese deficiency at birth, because the manganese is all going to the liver and the brain, to the brainstem in the mom, and not making it to the embryo or the fetus, you know. So the fetus ends up being born with manganese deficiency. And they may have figured out that there was a manganese deficiency problem, and that's why they put, because I think they actually put manganese into the soy. I mean, into the soy formula, thinking that more was needed. And then they found there was this huge problem because the child has the same problem the mom has, and it gets manganese concentration in the liver and the brainstem. That can go directly to the contribute to the brain disorders as well, like Parkinson's disease. I mean, that can cause Parkinson's disease.
Yeah, it's a very difficult problem to reverse once you have it.
When you're not managing the minerals correctly, and it's not just manganese. I mean, iron is a problem, and there's various deficiencies in cobalt for cobalamin and molybdenum. I mean, there's a bunch of them. Copper, they're all being disrupted by the glyphosate because the glyphosate is causing you to mismanage them. It chelates the minerals in the gut so the gut bacteria can't get to them. And the gut bacteria need the minerals to do their thing, you know, so they end up in trouble. Like, for example, lactobacillus really depends on manganese. They really have a very unusual mechanism to protect themselves from oxidative damage that involves high concentrations of manganese, but they can't get at it because it's hiding inside the glyphosate molecule.
Yeah.
It's really fascinating.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. One of my new passions is gardening, biological gardening and farming, and one of the applications I'm using and seeing phenomenal results, which is really optimizing the genetic potential of the plants, are foliar sprays mineral applications that are really have like 80 or 90 minerals are based or extracted from the sea. So once you supply the plant and effectively, because plants can absorb about 40 times better nutrients through their leaves than they can through the roots, you see this dramatic change. I mean, it's just like unlocks their genes. It's just fascinating experiment in biology to witness.
That's wonderful.
Yeah,
That's really interesting.
See that. But I couldn't agree more. Minerals are where it's at.
Absolutely, the minerals are totally a train wreck.
But making them bioavailable, you can't take a mineral supplement. It's got to be done in this whole complex, complex but yet simple and elegant fashion that the body utilizes the way it was designed to.
Yeah, and the sea salt is really important because that's got the right balance. You know, the minerals content in the sea is typically very well balanced with the different proportions because you can get toxic into trouble with toxicity if you take too much of one and not enough of another. You know, they have to be balanced and.
Mm-hmm.
So sea salt, of course, I mentioned that as something to use instead of table salt.
Which is one of the dangers of traditional industrial agriculture is that they use very few supplements, but they're all most like nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus. And potassium is a mineral, so is phosphorus, but they're using it as a single one out of balance and in a salt form, which actually kills the microbial life in the soil.
It
works short term. Long term, it's a disaster, an unmitigated disaster. Not only killing the other microbes, but decimating the topsoil and the life of the soil. It's just crazy.
I know. We're just totally ruining. America was probably fortunate to have such good soil.
Oh, we had some of the best soil in the world.
Population. You know, we had a long history of not that many humans here, so we weren't wrecking things in the early days. But now we're just making up for lost time.
On steroids. Now,
it's so horrible.
You have a relatively unusual position because most researchers or investigators into this are not in your privileged state, and it really is privileged because you've been working for many years. You're tenured over the MIT, and you're given the opportunity to pursue this research independently. Most researchers, they're in ag departments, and we know that every single major ag department is controlled by Monsanto and these. The producers, the purveyors of these chemicals. So if they come up with findings like yours, they'll lose their tenureship, they'll be fired, and you know they aren't able to do that. So we don't have a lot of independent voices like yourself,
researchers. Very sad.
When they do publish, they're ostracized and they're targeted for criticism to discredit them. That was the word I was searching for. Thank you. Discredit them.
Yeah.
I guess I have two questions. Have you noticed any efforts to discredit your work?
Absolutely. Yeah, they're doing the same thing with me, for sure. You know, you can find web pages where they try to, and they'll pick apart tiny parts of the paper that Anthony and I wrote and you know, make spurious arguments about why it's wrong and things like that. I mean, you know, you can't make a false move without them seeing it. They're pouring over the paper trying to find things that they might be able to criticize, and I think their criticisms are really weak, you know, but they make a big deal out of them because they're trying to
say
that what we're saying is not true.
They've got a lot at stake. So anyway, yeah. I put that frame just to give the understanding that there's not a lot of people like you who have the opportunity to go out there. So that is sort of the weakness of our position, because it's, everything else is really subsidized by the industry and it's all media brainwashing. So I'm wondering, you know, which part, and these companies have clearly infiltrated the federal regulatory agencies of the United States. So, I mean, there's no way that that's going to turn. So with EPA, the USDA, forget it. The FDA, it's not going to happen because they've got insiders and they're controlling it. So what is your take on the possibilities for the future? Is there any hope, or what's your comment on this?
I have hope through China and Russia.
Okay.
Interestingly enough, you know, Russia's made a pretty strong stand against GMOs.
That I am not aware of. Can you expand on that?
Yeah. No. Putin has been saying, you can go ahead and eat your GMO foods, but we don't want them. You know, I just love it. I just came back from a conference in Beijing. It was absolutely mind-boggling. It was so amazing. I was so thrilled to be invited to this. It was a conference put on by a Professor Gu in Beijing, and she brought in people from around the world, this very small community of people who are sounding the alarm about GMOs and Roundup. And everybody there gave a wonderful talk. It was a very intense two-day conference. And Don Huber was there. I'm sure you know Don Huber.
Sure, sure.
And Mei Wan Ho. I mean, these are just people that
leaders
I tremendously admire.
Right.
And Jeffrey Smith was there. And then from Australia, there was Judy Carman.
I've interviewed her, too. She's one of my heroes.
Yeah. Oh, it's just incredible, this conference. And very, very inspiring. And I think that if China doesn't have the kind of vested connection to Monsanto that we have, and we've got, you know, Missouri is their headquarters. The United States thinks this company walks on water, it seems like. I mean, I just do not understand how the U.S. government refuses to acknowledge that we're basically solely poisoning and killing our population. We're going to have huge, huge autism problems in 10 or 15 years. I mean, I can see it coming, and I don't know how to stop it.
Well, it's already here.
Mothers, you know, the mothers rise up and say, I'm going to feed my child organic food only. That's the only way we're going to stop it. We have to push the organic movement. So there's two things I'm hopeful about. One is the mothers in America. And, in fact, one of the people at this conference was Zen Honeycutt. Do you know who Zen Honeycutt is?
No, I haven't heard of her.
Oh, you should interview her. She's wonderful. She's the founder of Moms Across America, mm-hmm. which is an organization of moms. Her son had autism, and she fixed his autism by putting him on an organic diet. And so it's a anecdotal. And then she became a total believer in the dangers of pesticides and GMOs. And then so she actually took the initiative to have several moms in her community have their breast milk and their urine tested for glyphosate. There's very, very little testing going on, by the way, in the United States, almost none. In fact, none. I wasn't able to find any testing in any papers that were talking about
it. Is it a difficult test to get?
It is difficult. It's extremely difficult in America. Most companies refuse to even evaluate it. You know, it was very hard for them to even. Anthony Samsel helped them out, and they got this measure done. And these are mothers who are conscientious about trying to avoid GMO food. 30% of the mothers had glyphosate in their breast milk, and at higher levels than it was in their urine, which means it's bioaccumulating. Monsanto assures us that it doesn't bioaccumulate, but it's not true. And they had levels. The maximum level in the breast milk was 1,600 times as high as the level allowed in water in Europe. So you think you're feeding your child breast milk, you know, and you are. You're doing a good thing when you feed your child breast milk. But there's the glyphosate right there in the breast milk, you know?
Well, I've got a question for you about glyphosate pharmacology or pharmacokinetics. How do you detox from it? Is it fat soluble? Does it stick in your tissues? Is it broken down? Are there any ways to rapidly metabolize it out of your system?
You know, they've had some success with animals in feeding them charcoal. Mm-hmm. And
well, that would be good acutely if they've ingested it. But, I mean, what happens after it's ingested? Where does it hang out?
Yeah, I mean, it gets everywhere. It goes. They've measured it in several different organs in animal studies.
I think
it goes
in most all the cells. In plants, it's in all the cells. I mean, you can't wash it off a plant.
No,
that's
you can't
problem.
Wash it off for
it's
sure.
It's integrated into almost all the cells. I would imagine it happens the same thing in humans.
It does, yeah, well, so they've measured in chickens and then, you know, in pigs. They found it in all the tissues that they looked at, I think. I mean, there's a paper that I saw recently by a German woman whose name I'm going to forget. Monica Kruger. I believe she was the one who did a study that showed that it was present in the brain, in the liver, in the spleen, you know. And I know it's been found in the muscles of chickens, which is, of course, what you eat. So when you eat, you're not going to be avoiding glyphosate by eating chicken, you know, because they're getting tons of it, and it accumulates in their muscles. So it's pretty much all over the place.
Is it fair to say that animal products in general are going to have higher concentrations of glyphosate than plant products?
You know, I don't know.
Even wheat that's been doused with glyphosate.
I know. The wheat, you imagine, it has to be. Of course, they haven't measured it in the wheat. I couldn't get any numbers.
Oh.
Yeah, no, they're just like, let's just, you know, use the Oscar to play. It's very dangerous, you know. You've got all this stuff around you poisoning you, and you don't know which foods are safe. It's really frustrating. We eat 100% organic in my household, even organic spices, organic wine, you know. We have a wonderful organic wine that we found. So you can do organic wine actually without having to spend a lot of money.
Yeah, that's a wise approach for anyone. So I mean, that's sort of one of the strong take-home messages of this interaction, is to only eat organic, because almost every other food is going to be doused with glyphosate, which is really difficult to get rid of. Do you know of any ways to accelerate its removal, or?
So humus was another thing that was mentioned, charcoal and humus. In these talks I heard in Beijing, in animals, they give them humus, which is, I think, like soil, right? It's like the
humus is the end product. It's mostly carbon. It's digested carbon. When the microbes get to it and can keep on digesting or redigesting, they can't digest anymore. It's humus. And humus is pretty much stable in the soil for hundreds, if not thousands of years. It's really what retains the moisture. It's somewhat like biochar. You know, it's a stable form of carbon. So probably boils down to taking these carbon, but can that taken orally in the gut extract it from brain cells?
No, obviously not, but I guess as you dilute the supply, then eventually it might work its way out. I actually don't know. I mean, how could you know, right? It might stay in the brain forever, because some things do. I mean, the manganese is probably very hard to get out once it gets into the brainstem.
Yeah.
And it causes the Parkinson's, you know, destroys the substantia nigra.
Yeah, really the only therapy for that is like stem cells or something, where you can get new nervous tissue in there.
It's really, I know, it's so much harder to reverse it once it's there than it is to keep it out from the start, from the get-go, by just eating the organic food. And thank goodness, I mean, this is the one good thing about America, because in China, you know, I have a friend who just came back from China, and she said you couldn't get organic food there. It wasn't, I mean, you might be getting organic food if you're buying it from some farmer who's not using chemicals, but you don't have the certified organic that we have here, where it's been, you know, that the government has gone through a regulatory process to make sure that they're following the rules. And organic has to be definitely not GMO, and no use of these, you know, you can't be using any of these toxic chemicals. Of course, that includes glyphosate. So eating certified organic ought to be a pretty good step towards avoiding it. And more and more people eat it, I mean, a farmer would probably be willing to switch to organic if he thought, first of all, he could get a good price for the product, and he wouldn't have to expose himself to the toxic chemicals. You know, to me, if I were a farmer, that would seem like a good deal.
Yeah,
so if
no
people
question.
Are willing to buy it, spend a little more money and buy it, and that'll probably bring down the price, too, as more and more people buy it. You know, any kind of consumer good, if more people buy it, the price goes down, right?
Yeah, I know ultimately that recommendation relies on farmers recognizing it and supplying the product to individuals. My approach is a little different. I'm involved in a multi-year project to motivate, inspire, encourage, and educate individuals to grow their own food and to do that easily or effortlessly, which is the key, because if it's hard, people aren't going to do it. So that's
totally
one of my new missions. And I'm in the process of doing it. I've got a few experimental projects that are going right now to validate that approach. But I think it's doable. I'm absolutely convinced it's doable. So that's one other strategy. Are there any other strategies?
And that's a really important strategy, because I think there's going to be a run on organic once everybody wakes up. And then if you're not growing your own, you won't have access. You know, it'll be very difficult.
Yeah, and the key to this is it heals the planet, too, because you cannot grow this food easily and effortlessly unless you have incredibly healthy soil. And the key here is to creating a healthy soil actually utilizes waste product that typically makes the environment worse, typically like wood chips, and it heals the environment. So it's like a win, quadruple
win. It's a triple win,
all the way around.
And, of course, there's also the whole issue of the carbon, and I've been reading that as much as 60% of the global warming can be attributable to the agriculture as opposed
to... It's not burning fossil fuels isn't a useful, isn't helping things, but really it's the decimation of the perversion of the agricultural system, and then, you know, tilling the soil, one of the worst things you can do. And that's what they do when they spray these weeds. They don't not even spray glyphosate, and then they till the soil, which further worsens the problem.
Yeah, and then you don't get the carbon fixation in the soil, so the carbon goes into the air and causes the global warming, which may be an even bigger crisis than poisoning the population. I'm not sure which one. It's a race between those two as far as...
Yeah, there's a lot of people who would disagree with that, but, you know, we don't even have to go down there because we don't have to get into controversy. We just know that we've got enough issues right here, and if it clears up the global warming, great, but we don't even have to address that at all because it's healthy in despite of that.
It's so many ways that it's a win, and I think if we can really mobilize the population to take control of their food and grow their own food in whatever space they have in their backyard, that can be huge, you know? That can just be such a huge impact. And of course, I would love it if the government would take away all the subsidies that they're providing to this chemical agriculture and instead use that money, for example, to subsidize grass-fed beef, because grass-fed beef is an excellent solution, you know? You get the cows make the grass healthier than it would otherwise be.
Yeah,
and we can't eat the grass. So you're sort of turning grass into edible food, and you're saving the planet because you're improving the quality of the grass and helping to preserve the soil, you know?
Yeah, it definitely improves the health of the soil. There's many people who've written books on this and done studies and showed it really clearly that the herbivores, and the cows being the primary one in the U.S. at least, can have a phenomenal improvement in the soil if it's done properly. It has to be done. You just can't throw them on any pasture and feed them grass. They actually have to interact with the soil and do holistic herd management and mob grazing and those types of things, and it definitely improves soil. It improves the diversity of the crops that are, and the weeds that are growing in the plants. So it's just phenomenal stuff. So
very exciting. I think that we have... So I feel I have hope from the U.S. population, not from the government, because the government just seems to be completely wedded to the chemical
agriculture. I have enormous hope with the Russia and the China. China, of course, being the largest country in the world, population.
China could really have an impact if they simply refuse to import the GMO soy. They're finding, by the way, and I learned this from this conference, they're finding that in step with the increased imports of the GMO Roundup Ready soy, which, of course, soy is a big food item in China, and... they've been switching over to importing it because it's cheaper to import it than it is to grow it themselves because of this horrible way that this soy is grown. And they're finding tremendous increases in autism, Parkinson's disease, infertility, I mean, all the same things we're seeing here.
So are they moving towards a ban on GMO products?
I think they are. I think that's what they would love. Now, of course, there's opposition. You know, there's all the money that's going into trying to feed them the opposite point of view. But but there's certainly a pretty substantial community of, more mainstream. They're not just a fringe over there. You know, this conference all involves mainstream researchers in China who are concerned and aware of what's happening. And they don't have that vested interest in Monsanto that we have.
No, that's true. I mean, there's a lot of downsides to China and Russia, and I'm sure those downsides are probably perverted by our media. But clearly what's undisputable is that they don't have that, what you just mentioned, this massive vested corporate interest that dictates the governmental policy.
Right. So that's why I think it may be easier to break the barriers there.
Absolutely fascinating discussion. I'm just delighted to learn this relatively new information and to share it with others and to know there's hope and encouragement that we have a strategy that can be effective both personally and on a larger global scale, that there's some hope. So I'm wondering if there's any closing comments you have to sort of summarize this or maybe emphasize some of the points you mentioned earlier.
Yes, well, I hope that listeners are convinced that there's an issue here and that they need to, if they haven't already, they need to change their lifestyle practices, you know, towards eating whole organic foods instead of buying all these processed foods that are loaded with chemicals and the GMOs themselves, which I didn't talk about, but those are also, they have serious issues. And I learned about that, in fact, more in the Beijing conference. Pretty scary stuff with the GMOs, which I didn't talk about. But there's many, many reasons to avoid these processed foods that our government is encouraging us to eat. And And, of course, taking complete ownership of your food by growing your own is the most special thing you can do, not just for yourself, but for humanity and for the earth itself. So everyone who pitches in to contribute their piece of healthy grown food with healthy, developing healthy soil, so important to our future salvation, because I think we're going to be, if we don't move fast with this, we're going to end up with a country that's so sick. I mean, you just see our medical expenses just skyrocketing.
Well, they are now. It's $3 trillion for substandard health care.
It's just crazy. We can't keep on. You know, we're going to spend all of our time and all of our money taking care of the sick and needy in our country. We won't be able to do anything else, you know. And this is not a pleasant life. So we need to move quickly and individually make ourselves healthy by eating healthy foods, by putting in the effort to cook, the effort to grow the food ourselves, which I really like that you're pushing that. And, of course, buy organic, support the organic farmers. Don't worry about the fact that it's costing you a little more on food, because it's going to save you a huge amount on health care down the road. It's going to totally repay for itself. And if people can get into that mindset, we can make it happen as individuals. We don't need the government. I would love it if the government would step in and do something dramatic. The government could do a huge amount if they would. I have been very frustrated in lack of response from the government. You know, I've had friends who have sent...
But shouldn't be surprised.
No, they send letters, you know, pointing out and attaching all these articles that are showing all the dangers. And many times they don't even get an acknowledged response, you know,
sure.
Or maybe a form letter. I mean, it's just... I'm sure the government's getting overwhelmed with all this stuff that's coming in, but they're not looking at it, you know. If they would just look at it, they would see what a mess we're in and that we have to do something. But as long as... the government. We can take the position that the government's not going to save us here. We need to save ourselves. And we can do so. We can empower ourselves and we can feel good about ourselves that we're contributing to the solution rather than to the problem.
Yes, indeed.
So I would encourage everybody listening to, you know, if they haven't already done it, change their lifestyle in this direction.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. And, you know, just to highlight that point, many people may not be aware that 70%, that's nearly three-fourths of the world's food, is grown in small farms or people's backyards. It's probably well under 2 or 1% in the United States. It wasn't always that way. We had Victory Gardens in World War I and II, and 40%, almost half of the food, was grown in people's backyards. And we can do it again. We can do it again.
It is war.
It's war on the human race.
Yeah.
And we really need to take a movement in the right direction. But, you know, we all have busy lives. This way it has to be simple and effortless. And I just encourage people to stay tuned, because we're really going to be making a strong effort to provide that information and make it as seamless and simple as possible. So thank you for all your work, for your continuing research, for being out there, one of the beacons of hope and knowledge and information to really educate us and arm us and defend the others who don't understand the truth, because the media is just overwhelming us. They're shills, they're scientific shills that are telling us misinformation, and, you know, all really motivated to increase the profits of these tech companies that are, you know, producing these pernicious chemicals.
Right.
So keep up the good work.
Thank you.
All right. So
I think talking is great. Thank you so much for doing this.
Wow. Let's all take a deep breath after that. Yikes. That was amazing. That was, you know, I was taking furious notes over here, and I bet everybody listening was as well. That was really, wow. Stephanie Seneff wraps it down with Dr. McCullough. That was great. I suggest that you tell all your friends about this show. This show will be available at soundhealthoptions.com. Click on the radio tab and then click on Blog Talk Radio, and there's a player down there at the bottom of the page where you can listen to it. And you can also go to iTunes and subscribe. That's really cool to subscribe at iTunes, because then you just get the feeds automatically if you are an iTunes user. And you can also find it on Stitcher and any of the other podcast aggregators. I would send this show to your friends. It's also in chat here at Blog Talk Radio and also at the WebEx feed. There is a transcript of this show. Well, that'd be a serious read. But it's really amazing. That was awesome. Thanks, Dr. McCullough, for, you know, suggesting we get this out there. So, yeah, everybody take a deep breath, have a great weekend, and we will see you on Tuesday. Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye. Oh, happy Valentine's Day to everybody. Bye.